Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 326. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. Very excited to be back. We have a very special episode today. I have my guest with me this afternoon is Matt Perman, who has formerly served as the Senior Director of Strategy at Desiring God Ministries in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And currently, he consults and speaks and writes books on all sorts of things, particularly these days about productivity and, more than that, being effective in our labors, especially from a Christian perspective and a Christian foundation. Welcome to the program, Matt. It's great to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're excited to speak today about Matt's new book, which is already in its second print run. Yes, that's right. They've sold out, but it's back on the shelves, and you can get a copy of What's Best Next, How the Gospel Transforms the Way You Get Things Done. It is by Matt Perman with a foreword by John Piper, and it is published by Zondervan. So you can find it all sorts of places at Amazon.com. WTSBooks.com has a great price on it. It's a lovely book. It's designed exquisitely, very easy to read, but not because it's light. It's well thought out. It's rich, and it's going to be good for you to pick up a copy of this book. And we're going to open that and talk about it today. But before we do so, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. We encourage you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. We're really encouraged by the recent swell of support we've had, and we encourage you also to sign up maybe for a $5 or $10 a month plan. It helps us to cover our cost and to be able to schedule more of these interviews, and as well as to get out throughout the country and meet people. So help support us today, reformedforum.org/donate. We want to thank all of our listeners and everyone for supporting us here at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Now, Matt, I'm so excited to be able to get you on the program. I know you're a busy man, and rightfully so. There are a lot of people that are wanting to talk to you about this book, and that's because it has such a wide appeal. And it's such an important topic when we're talking about productivity. But sometimes people might misunderstand what we mean by productivity. Could you just introduce very quickly as we get started kind of the meaning of that word and what your hope is in terms of offering a gospel-driven view of productivity?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, most of the time when we think of productivity, we think of getting more things done faster, efficiency. And the very first thing I want to say in the book is that's not, first of all, what I'm talking about, because more important than efficiency is effectiveness. Effectiveness means getting the right things done. And that's ultimately how we need to define productivity, because it doesn't matter how fast you're going if you're doing the wrong things in the first place. So our first concern needs to be making sure we're getting the right things done. Then once we have that in place, that's when efficiency becomes important.
Yeah, that's such a helpful view. And sometimes people have a general aversion to productivity because it sounds like business ease, you know, business lingo, or sounds like something that you find on the self-help shelf at Barnes & Noble or something like that. You know, And I had a view of that type of thing just several years ago, just not to make this all about me, but just to provide a little background, and maybe you can help me here. I did some business training. I did an MBA out of college and actually did some research in business management techniques. That was part of my job when I was a grad assistant, to do some of that sort of thing, and studied project management, and I was interested in all sorts of things. I read a lot of business literature and different approaches to life. And so I've always had some sort of an interest in productivity and management techniques. But when I actually went off to seminary, I kind of tried to divide that or contain that experience and those books and that knowledge I had in a separate place and keep it hermetically sealed, as it were, from theology or from the church, because ministry is not business, at least in my mind, and the two should never be mixed or blended together. How can you help us to understand how business principles in a healthy way, in the right way, can be understood through the lens of common grace and actually help us to become better followers of Christ and better lovers of one another?
Yeah, well, that's a fantastic question, a really, really good question. And that's part of the reason I actually encountered a lot of pushback when I started learning about productivity, actually. I have a strong theological background, actually. In college, it was a secular university, but I was always reading theology. And then I studied under John Piper and got my MDiv, went to seminary, got my MDiv. Strong theological background. Then I started working at Desiring God, and I had all of these projects I had to do, launch a nationwide radio program, redesign the website. And I realized I need to know more than theology. So I started learning how to get things done and reading business books. Mm-hmm. And I loved the business books I was reading. I was like, this is amazing. It's like some people like Jim Collins, it's like he's like the John Piper of business thinking. He's profound and engaging to read. Mm-hmm. But I started getting pushback. People were saying things like, you know, well, the church is not a business, mm-hmm. and et cetera, et cetera. And I was puzzled by that for a while because I was finding these business books so helpful. But here's the conclusion I came to. Here's what I realized. There's good business thinking and there's bad business thinking. And what had happened, I think the people that were giving me pushback and saying, don't learn from the business thinkers, what their experience with business thinking had been with the bad business thinking. Mm. And then they thought that all business thinking was like that. But it's not. Mm-hmm. So we need to distinguish. There really is bad business thinking out there. The kind of thinking that sees business as being only about the money, only about the bottom line, only about efficiency. Here's the thing. We should not bring that stuff into the church. Mm-hmm. We should not. The church is not to be run that way with the primary eye on the bottom line. Terrible. We are not
with numbers, you know, with how many people are in the pews or how many sites do we have and how many are we reaching with our broadcast, that type of thing.
Exactly.
Misses the point. Mm.
And here's the amazing thing though that I found. Mm. So when people try and take that kind of business thinking over into the church, the thing I found is the problem is not just that business thinking is bad in the church. It's also bad in the business world. This is what the best business thinkers are actually showing, like Jim Collins and Tim Sanders and others. Even in the business world, this putting your primary concern on profit and numbers actually undermines your business in the long run. Mm-hmm. So people like Jim Collins argues in Built to Last that the most effective businesses actually see themselves as existing first to make a contribution, not to make money. And then he shows that those are the businesses that actually make the most money in the long run. So mm-hmm. it's actually better for business not to put money first. And those are the business thinkers I was learning from. And that is a very biblical perspective. So that's why when I was reading business thinking, I was saying, this is amazing. They are echoing biblical truth. We need to learn from this. And these other people, they had read different business books and they were saying, no, business thinking is bad. So what I found is we just need to distinguish between good business thinking, bad business thinking. Don't take the bad business thinking stuff into the church. And also realize the bad business thinking is bad for the business world too. Mm-hmm. But in the good business thinking, we got a lot to learn from because it is echoing common grace. It is a gift of God. Certainly, there are still differences between the church and the business world. So the good business thinking, it does need to be adapted to the church because the church still does have different purposes, you know, than a business. But there is still a whole lot to learn. And I found it very beneficial in my life, not just in learning how to get things done and manage everything I had going on when I was at Desiring God, but it helped us lead the organization. It helped us know how to clarify our mission and values and lead from values rather than rules. And we were really, really helped by good business thinkers like Jim Collins.
Mm-hmm. You know, it is so useful, and there's a definite theological base here as we unpack this. We're going to get more into the theological angle of productivity and better than that, you know, being effective in our lives. And a lot of this rests on the fifth commandment, at least in my church tradition. The Westminster Standards speak about the fifth commandment and describes our responsibilities to inferiors, but also to superiors. So it's expanding the understanding of honor thy father and mother to include all of our relationships and whatever roles we may be in. We have obligations to one another, but also the two great commandments. To love the Lord our God with our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves has everything to do with how we carry ourselves and how we go about our lives. What we're called to do and how we do it is all about productivity. Here in the subtitle to your book, What's Best Next, you mentioned how the gospel transforms the way you get things done. Now, some people in the know are going to understand what GTD means, but can you unpack that for people and describe a little bit of this subculture that's out there in case people are unfamiliar? Where does that name come from?
So I am alluding to David Allen's very helpful book there, Getting Things Done. Mm-hmm. David Allen is a pioneer in knowledge era productivity. His book, Getting Things Done, came out, I think, in 2001, and it's been a lifesaver for so many people. And he starts out by just identifying the problem. We have to define our work these days. Back in the industrial era, we didn't have to do that as much because our work was self-evident. But today we're dealing with email, text messages, all this input coming our way. We have to define our work. And then he gives you a process for keeping track of all the actions you've defined. And it's a really helpful process for managing your work. It's the most helpful I've found. And I think millions of people now over the last 10 years have become excited about the approach David Allen lays out because it is so helpful. And there's this big movement, and it's called GTD, for getting things done. And I am deliberately alluding to that because I found it so helpful. But the one thing it lacks, and I can't fault David Allen for this because, I mean, he's not a believer. He's not seeking to write from a biblical perspective. But as Christians, we need to think about all of life from a biblical perspective. And that includes how we get things done. And so my heart in this book was to present not just a way to get things done, but how to think about it in a gospel-centered way and then go about getting things done in a gospel-centered way as well.
Yeah, that's so helpful. And if anyone just types GTD into Google or some other search engine, you'll see a wealth of resources and tools and all sorts of different approaches that have all been spawned, at least in name, by David Allen's book. I've read David's book several times. I've also listened to a lot of podcasts and heard a lot of people talking online about his approach, and I've used it in my own life. I'm not as good about it as I'd like to be. We'll get to that in a minute about sometimes our systems becoming a new law. I resonated with that. But it's important that we are intentional about what we do rather than having a reactionary workflow to be able to be good stewards about the time and the resources that we have. Can you speak, Matt, about the biblical principle of stewardship and also discipleship? Those are two thoughts that are very evident in your book. I love how you develop them. What do those mean, and how do they actually apply, not only to our finances and things like that, but also to our relationships and to the time that we have in the day?
Yeah. Stewardship is critical because we're not ultimate owners of anything we have, not even ourselves.
Yeah.
We are not our own. We are stewards. We are stewarding what God has given us. And that means we need to use everything we have according to His will and His principles and His purposes. And most of the time when we think of stewardship, we only think of money.
Yeah.
And then even there, we reduce it down to, just give 10%. That's what good stewardship is. But I believe, and the Bible is clear on this, our stewardship extends to far more than just money. It includes our time, and thus time management is important. It includes our abilities and gifts. It includes our relationships. Everything you have is a gift from God and is to be used for His glory. And the parable of the talents lays this out very clearly. The master in that parable gives, one servant five talents, another three, and another one, and he expects a return from each of them. And what Jesus is showing us there is he demands a return on our lives. We are to take everything he's given us and invest it for his purposes, and that will bear fruit such that on the day of judgment, we are to give back to him more than he gave to us. Now, I don't mean that in a Pelagian sense of self-effort. I mean that done in his power. Every God is crowning his own gifts, as Augustine said. But we are to take what he's given us, not just our money, but also our skills and gifts, and invest it in ways that will bring good for others and advance the gospel. And that's what good stewardship is. And productivity means being a maximum steward of your time, talents, and money.
Absolutely. I love that approach. And when we think of things that way, it's really freeing in the sense that we get to glorify God in whatever we do, and reminds us of the Reformed doctrine of vocation. And we're liberated in a sense, and we're no longer slaves to our schedule, so to speak, but have the opportunity to use what God has given to us for the advancement of His kingdom and for the building up of His church and for His pleasure, and therefore our own pleasure as well. One thing I love here is you developed a GDP approach, not gross domestic product. We're talking gospel-driven productivity. Yep. Is the idea that really what we want to do is to allow us to get good works done. Yes, we have tasks and things throughout the day that we need to do, and those things glorify God too. But all of our lives should be about serving other people and blessing the Lord through those endeavors. How does it help to think about our productivity in light of Ephesians 2:10, for instance, thinking about the good works that God has laid out for us to do?
Yep. I think it gives new meaning to the things we do every day when we understand Ephesians 2:10 and how it relates to our productivity. So yeah. I argue in the book that good works are anything we do in faith. Mm-hmm. Ephesians 2:10 says we're created in Christ Jesus for good works. So doing good works is one of the purposes of our salvation.
Yeah.
A lot of times, though, we think of good works, we have this very narrow view of them. We think of them as things we do maybe every once in a while, like go to the soup kitchen or take a mission trip to Africa.
Right, right.
It's like we think of good works as things on our someday maybe list. You know, maybe I'll get to do a good work next month. But the biblical conception of good works is much broader than that. Good works are anything we do in faith. Later in Ephesians 6, actually, Paul refers to the work that Christian slaves do as a good thing, showing he has a very comprehensive view of good works. And so what I argue is when we are being productive, so to speak, like doing email, going to meetings, or even making dinner for the family, we are not just doing those things. We are doing good works. We are living out Ephesians 2:10, and that means that the things we do every day have great meaning and value. Nothing is worthless. Everything matters.
Mm-hmm. It sure does. But why is it so tough then? I mean, of course, we have the problem of sin, and we tend to be lazy or more than that, self-serving. But speaking in terms of practicality, let's put an edge on this and get down to brass tacks. Why is it so hard to be productive? What are the things that really attack and assail us day to day that prevent us from being effective in our lives?
I think there are two main villains these days, overload and ambiguity. Mm. So first there's overload. There is just so much coming at us. There is so much. I mean, a lot of us get 100 emails a day. Text messaging has blown up over the last 5 years. So I can sit down to you know, maybe write a blog post or do something that requires concentration, and I'll get a text message from California and then another one from Florida. It reminds me of passing notes in class. You know,
right, right.
Except you can get notes from anywhere in the world.
Right.
So we got a lot coming our way. It takes a lot of time and effort to keep up with that. And then ambiguity, that goes back to the issue of we have to define our work. For most of us now, our work is not given to us predefined by a manager, you know, working over us. We have to define our work and figure out what to do. And that's a skill unto itself, which as a society, I don't think we've recognized very much. And thus, we haven't been trained how to do it. Well, when you bring together ambiguity and the need to define our work with overload, the fact that we have so much we need to define, you have a perfect storm of people swallowed up, not totally knowing what to do or where to start. So that's what makes it really hard. And that's why we need to learn the unique skill of knowledge work and how to manage our knowledge work.
How has Peter Drucker been helpful for you on this? I know I've read several of his books. Yeah. I'm reading more of them now after you've suggested them and used some helpful quotations. What is his thought about this new knowledge economy?
Yeah, I love Peter Drucker. His book, The Effective Executive, is one of the best books on mm-hmm. productivity out there. He really nails it. Drucker's the one, I believe, who initially coined the term knowledge work mm-hmm. and identified this problem. Way back in the 50s, he saw the transformation our economy and society was undergoing, and he put his finger on it. And he's the one who first said that the chief challenge of the knowledge worker is to define his work. A knowledge worker cannot be managed in detail. Like a factory worker can be managed in more detail. But a knowledge worker, he's working with ideas. Much of the work is going on in his head, in his mind. You can't see that happening. So the way to manage the knowledge worker effectively is not to supervise him closely and in detail. Drucker says the knowledge worker cannot be managed closely or in detail. He can only be helped. Mm-hmm. So now the role of a manager is to be a source of help and to help the knowledge worker identify the right things. That goes back to effectiveness, not efficiency. And his book, The Effective Executive, is all about how to define what the right things are. And Drucker, he's coming from a very biblical perspective. He's not writing a Christian book. He's not usually quoting scripture, mm-hmm. but he is in line with the biblical worldview because he calls out the fact that, for example, in order to know what the right things are to do, you have to focus on contribution and service. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very biblical emphasis. And his point is, if you focus on just what you want to do and your own interests and making things better for yourself, not thinking about others, you're going to be defining the wrong things to do. And so you will not be effective. And what we see running through business thinkers like Drucker and Jim Collins and others is what you mentioned earlier about the great commandment, love God and love your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah.
They're reflecting the second part of the great commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. They're not saying it explicitly, but it's woven through their ethic. The command to love our neighbor as ourselves applies at work. It doesn't just apply in our personal lives. It applies at work. And we are to make the good of others one of our chief criterion for knowing what is the right thing to do and what's best next.
It is so hard to define, and a lot of people are knowledge workers these days. As you mentioned, you know, in the factory or even on the farm, your work is laid out for you, and it's not too hard to think about what you have to do today. Milk the cows, you know, we have to do these widgets. I stand on this part of the line, and then the work comes to me, and I do my job. I'm measured based on a quota or, you know, how many widgets I produce or whatever I do, and I go home. That's easy to define. Not necessarily easy work, but it's easy to define. Yeah. But today, like you said, we get stuff from all over the place, and we're producing knowledge. We're working in the realm of ideas. But also many of us, well, all of us are called to work with and help other people. And people are tough to define. But if we think about, you know, our interactions with people strictly within the paradigm of efficiency, we really end up in a quandary, because then we think about, well, these 3 hours I spent with someone, you know, talking to them about their depression, I don't have a deliverable. Yeah. And therefore, I must be inefficient, and therefore, I must have wasted my time. How does the effectiveness mindset and also this gospel-driven productivity mindset totally change our view about those 3 hours we might have spent with a brother or sister in need?
Yeah, the effectiveness mindset frees you up to serve your brother and sister in need, because it says productivity is not chiefly measured by tangible outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so if you spend 3 hours talking with your friend about his depression, that's an incredibly productive thing to do, mm-hmm. because you are serving him, you're meeting his needs. You can be efficient with things, but you can't be efficient with people. You can't say to your friend, I got to slot you into a 48-minute time slot. And at the end of 40 minutes, if he's in the midst of this sob story and you cut him off and say, sorry, our time's up, that is a horrible thing to do.
Yeah.
So you can't do that with people. You need to be willing to even break your schedule when necessary in order to meet the needs in front of you. And this is really a wonderful thing, too, because it means at the end of the 3 hours talking with your friend, don't beat yourself up for all the emails you didn't get through and for the lack of more tangible deliverables. Because what I argue from gospel-driven productivity is serving people and building relationships is actually one of the key things that God calls us to do. And it is productive, even though it's not immediately measurable.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that leads us into the second main point here of your book. You know, define is so important and central, but here in the second part, you speak about architecting. We're creating a flexible schedule. Having defined what's important and what needs to be done And again, that is in developing relationships, doing good works, blessing other people, being obedient, basically, to the call of Christian. What are some principles and some thoughts that you can provide our listeners about creating a flexible schedule? Where do we even begin by doing that?
Well, it is helpful to create a schedule for your week so that you have a place for the most important things. The first step is define, identify what's most important. And then, though, you can't just leave that at the level of intentions. You need to weave it into the structure of your life, or you're never going to do those things. And that's what Architect is about, creating a basic template for your week with time slots for some of the most important things to do. So if you're a blogger, having a time slot every day to blog, or maybe it's three times a week, don't just say, okay, I need to blog sometime this week. Weave that into a schedule and have a basic schedule that you don't have to, you know, redo every week. Also keep it flexible, though, because of the fact that we don't know everything in advance. We are not omniscient, and certain things are going to take a lot longer than we expect, and unexpected things are going to come our way. So that's why I emphasize having a flexible framework, not a rigid framework. And what this does is it lets you keep your focus on the most important things without being closed to conscience-directed change.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's something you also point out here with GTD. David Allen's approach is very helpful, but it struggles a little bit in terms of the higher level planning and the scheduling. And that's something I found too with his approach. I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I still found myself with this big list of projects. And even if I was reviewing everything weekly, like you're supposed to, I still struggled because it was a massive stuff. And that's something that Stephen Covey really brings into view when he talks about his second quadrant. I believe it's things that are important but not urgent, if I'm correct. Why is it important to make room in your schedule to think about those things and also to do things that might not be urgent, so they aren't immediately going to press themselves upon you in your daily activities? But nevertheless, if you fail to do them, you really lack guidance and direction in your long-term life.
Yeah, you do. Well, and I experienced the same thing with GTD that you described. I mean, sometimes I felt like I was spending all my time defining my work, and then I had no time left.
Playing with my tools, you know.
Let's play with
OmniFocus for a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, man, I spent so much time fiddling with that, finding the best way to set it up. And finally I said, okay, this is not good. This is not helpful. And Covey was a helpful solution there. I don't think David Allen gives enough place to schedule and framework. And that's why the two linchmen of my system are actually David Allen's Getting Things Done and Stephen Covey's approach in First Things First.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think Covey makes up for some of the weaknesses of GTD, which is really, really helpful. But and of course, Covey's main emphasis is focus on the important over the urgent, and that's great. And in fact, the goal of so-called enlightened time management is to enable you to maximize the time you spend on the important as opposed to the merely urgent. And that's a good goal because the important things, so there's the four quadrants, you know, and most of us are usually in the quadrant of important and urgent. And that's good. It's okay to be in that quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we fall into the quadrant of urgent but not important.
Exactly.
That's a waste. But then there's the quadrant two, which is important but not urgent. And that's actually where the most important things usually are, because the most important things are usually long-term things. They might not bear fruit for 3 months or a year, and so they're not pressing upon you. So if you decide what to do simply on the basis of what's pressing hardest on you, you're going to ignore the quadrant of the important but not urgent. And that means you might be getting a lot of immediate short-term results, but you are undermining your long-term effectiveness. You are not doing the things that are necessary to set you up for success 3 months from now, 6 months from now.
Yeah.
So that's why it's very important to carve out time for the important but not urgent. That's where you will get the biggest results. And a lot of the reasons we have so many fires to put out is because, you know, 3 months ago, when the item was important but not urgent, we didn't do it. And then 3 months later, it blows up because now it's both important and urgent.
Mm-hmm.
But now we did that with so many things. We got so many fires to put out that we're scrambling everywhere. And it's even harder to carve out time for the important but not urgent. But what's especially unique about that category is how hard it is to do it, because those things are not pressing upon you. So it takes initiative. You have to be proactive to do those things. And I think that's a call for Christian character. Yeah. You have to take responsibility for yourself and take action and be the initiator, not merely the responder.
You know, just as a result of reading your book, I've started to take some steps to be better at those second quadrant type activities. And I have a special spot in my schedule where I actually read, you know, and as a pastor, I need to be reading theology and other things for the long term, for the benefit of my church and for teaching and also to support the preaching, but also strategy and vision, those types of things. If you don't place them into your schedule, you have an excellent illustration where if you don't put these big rocks into your schedule and all the other little things start getting put in, the smaller rocks, the gravel and the sand, if those big rocks aren't put in first, then the sand will fill everything up. Yep. And you won't have any time for anything else. You need to do first things first, like Peter Drucker says, and one thing at a time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The sand and gravel are usually the small things and the urgent things. They're yep. pressing at you. And it's tempting to think, oh, if I just do all this stuff, I'll get it out of the way, and then I'll have room for the big things. Yeah. But that's a trick. It doesn't really work that way, because the sand and gravel multiplies and ends up fill in your whole container. So the trick is to put the big rocks in first. That is the important but not urgent things, which usually take chunks of time and concentration, and put those in your schedule first. Focus on those first. And then there will be time in between for the smaller sand and gravel. Sometimes you just need a break, for example, from the important but not urgent things. Mm-hmm. And it's a good change of pace then to do some of the urgent things and the smaller things. One of the things I found with GTD is it oriented me towards the sand and gravel rather than the big rocks.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one reason I started developing my own system. I wanted to solve that problem. And I felt like the problem wasn't, first of all, me, though certainly that was part of the problem, but the problem was largely the system, because systems can incline you towards certain behaviors. So sometimes if you change the system, you will change your behaviors. And I think all the lists David Allen has you create, all these next action lists and stuff, incline you to want to just get stuff off that list because it's so long. And so you start doing the small stuff instead of the important, non-urgent stuff.
And then you tend more towards the efficiency model, and you feel like you had a good day at work if you checked 15 things off. But if you got a phone call and you were only able, therefore, to do 5 things on your list, all of a sudden you feel like you wasted your time, even though you didn't. You're probably more effective.
Probably more effective, but now you feel like you wasted your time and you're feeling guilty.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. That's the rub. So that's why this is so helpful to have a better, you know, more godly perspective on our work. Let's talk about reducing. I think a lot of people are just maybe overwhelmed by the amount of things in their life. And even if they are important, doesn't necessarily mean they need to be the ones to do them. How do we go about reducing our schedules or the amount of things in our schedule so that we may free up our time for what's most important for us?
I mean, one of the most important principles there is know your own unique gifts and callings.
That's the stewardship again.
Yes, it goes back to stewardship. You know, when I was interviewing theologian Wayne Grudem for this book, he talked a lot about that, actually. And most of that part of the conversation didn't make it into the book. But he talked about what he knows about his own gifts and how that helps him choose what to do. Like back during the open theism controversy, for example, he wrote almost nothing on that, he said. And the reason was there were so many others that were writing on it and doing such a good job. He felt like it wasn't necessary for him to join in that debate, and his gifts enabled him to contribute in other areas that were just as important at the time. And I thought that was smart. That was he knew his gifts and his unique role. And we need to know ourselves that way in order to know what to let go, what to reduce. If you're doing things that anybody else can do, you're probably shortchanging the world, because you're not focusing on what you've been uniquely gifted to do. Mm-hmm. You have something unique, unique things you can do that you can contribute that no one else can. So you need to focus on those things as much as possible. Otherwise, the world will be without what you have uniquely to offer. And then I give a acronym for the process.
Yeah, I like this. I know you say you don't like it, but I liked it. It's easier for me to remember.
It spells dead. Yeah. That's why I don't like it. I thought about rearranging the letters to avoid that. I was like, oh no, it can be memorable. And it does apply because it's about killing from your schedule the things that right. you shouldn't be doing. And it's just four things. The first D is for delegate. And that's where I focus most of my time on, because that is one of the best ways to reduce. I identify the things that are not for you to do and delegate them to others. And that means not go for delegation where you're managing people in detail saying, go for this, go for that. That's just treating people like machines or gophers. I don't think that is a respectful way to treat people generally. And I argue that the call to glorify God and love our neighbor, it applies to everything we do. That means even delegating. So we need to delegate in a way that builds up the person, that doesn't just see them as a tool, but sees them as meaningful in themselves. And that means we need to practice stewardship delegation,
yes,
which means delegating whole responsibilities to people and making sure the outcomes are clear, but allowing them freedom to choose their own methods, because that builds people up and builds their wisdom and maturity and character, because they have to take initiative and responsibility. So that's a way to delegate in a way that serves people.
In the long run, it's more effective and scalable too. I mean, I think that we probably have a lot of pastors and also lay leaders in the church that are listening right now, and they can readily understand if you practice gopher delegation and you're overseeing everybody and you're actually micromanaging the way people do things, you can only delegate then to a couple people, because you're the one that has to expend all this energy and effort to do the work rather than empowering others to use their own gifts to do things more effectively than you could.
Yeah, gopher delegation is exhausting and it doesn't scale.
Yeah, and it is disrespectful to the person, yeah, as you mentioned. Yeah,
it's disrespectful. So yeah, that is exactly right. Gopher delegation is not effective in reducing.
No, it adds more work.
It adds more work. Whereas stewardship delegation, really, it increases your capacity, and it is an amazing thing. Then the E is for eliminate, just get rid of stuff. A is for automate. Put things on autopilot. I have certain routines. They come up in I have a task calendar with repeating tasks. And like every Saturday, I have a set of tasks I do around the house. And once a month, or maybe it's every 3 months, you know, there's things like replace the furnace filter and add more rock salt to my water softener. And yeah, I don't have to think about those. I never have to sit back and say, oh, do I need to change the furnace filter? I can forget about it because that task is going to come up at the right time. And then the last D is for defer. And that's just putting things off to a future date. And it's cool. You can, just like you can schedule appointments, you can schedule tasks and put them in the future. There's something, yeah, that needs to be done, but not now. Put it, to come up in your task calendar, you know, 3 months from now. And then it comes up and at that time, it'll be appropriate to do. But it wasn't appropriate to do 3 months ago. It wasn't a good use of time then. And by scheduling it out in the future, you don't got to worry about it.
Yeah. And when you do all these things correctly, DEAD, delegation, elimination, automation, and deferring, then you actually will have a handle. And you'll be able to transition out of a reactionary workflow into one where you're flexible to serve, you're able to, with sanity, exercise, you know, Ephesians 2:10, and also be able to practice, as Peter says, the varied grace that each of us has received as a steward. I love how you put that. We're each are living stones in the body, and if we're not occupying our place in that structure, then the whole body suffers. So you've talked about dead, just as a really bad joke. Let's talk now about execution, but a different kind of execution. Execute, do what's most important. How to actually put this into practice and do it. Let's start here with weekly planning. What does this look like for you, and how might you suggest this for workers of all varieties?
Well, it used to be my weekly planning would take like 6 hours. It was... It was horrible. Because I was mired in the GTD abyss, I suppose, of all these lists, and I'd have 100 projects.
Yeah.
And I'd review all those projects, create next actions. It took me forever to do my weekly review. So I came up with a better process, which now takes about 15 minutes. I think weekly planning, if you can only do one productivity practice, this is the one to do. Sometimes, you know, people will read a productivity book and they say, well, I can't do all this. And yeah, I understand people are at different spots. And some people can implement everything, and other people, they just have to start with one or two things, and that's okay. And weekly planning is, I think, if you can only do one thing, the place to start, because that is what allows you to go into your week with proactive mode rather than reactionary workflow. And what I do, I mean, you can add a lot to it, but the gist of it is, ask yourself two questions. First, what needs to be done this week? And second, what do I want to do this week? And usually about 8 to 10 things will come to mind. 8 to 10 important and not urgent things. Those are the big rocks. Just list those. And then there's going to be a bunch of smaller stuff that comes to mind. Things you can do in just a few minutes even. That's kind of the sand and the gravel. And I encourage doing this. You don't even have to necessarily look at your project lists or next action lists, because a lot of times if we just stop and reflect, the important things become clear. But to supplement this, you can, you know, look at the other lists that you have. I mean, that's certainly a useful thing to do. But the point is to identify the few most important big rocks you need to accomplish this week. And again, about 8 to 10 things will come to mind. You probably cannot do all 8 to 10 of those. That's why the next step is to prune. Say, okay, of these 8 things, what are the maybe 3 that really are most important among these things I listed? And then slot those into your schedule for the week. Yeah. Put them on your calendar.
And emphasize here, weekly too. It's tough to do this daily, so because the weekly unit is a little bit easier to have a handle on and to think in terms of the week. Because stuff happens each and every day. And when we only schedule daily, I think we have too much of a micro view that it actually becomes a little disheartening.
I agree with that. It's like a photographer.
Yeah.
You know, photographers have different lenses, and the daily lens is just too narrow. You can't really see the big picture. A monthly lens is kind of too broad. The weekly lens is just about right.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I would encourage, of course, everyone to pick up this book and get all the details. This book is laid out so well in terms of being able to find links to places, and there are breakout boxes here that summarize things, but also little interviews that happen along the way. But before I let you go, I would love to give you the time to share some practical tips about managing email and workflow, because I know people are probably working on their email right at this moment as they're listening to this podcast. What are some quick steps or some tips for processing your work, not only email, but also just daily execution for managing the things that happen every day?
Yeah, the most important thing for email is to realize your inbox is for unprocessed items, is not for storing items.
I keep telling my wife this. Yes.
Yeah. it's not a to-do list. Your inbox is not a to-do list. It's for unprocessed things. So once you open an email, you've got to do something with it. You can't just look at an email, say, oh, I'll deal with it later, keep it in your inbox, go on to the next thing. So either do that email right away if it can be done in 2 minutes or less, or if it can't, then identify the action, put it on a list. And then if you need the original email for support material or something, I recommend having a folder, actually. Just call it support or whatever. Put the email over there. But run your life from a list, not your inbox. And then when you're done with an email, you know, like let's say it's a 2-minute action, you do it right away, then you delete the email. Mm-hmm. Don't say, well, maybe I'll need to refer to it again tomorrow. I'll leave it in the inbox. No. Delete that thing. If you do need to refer back to it, you just go into your deleted items bin, which I never permanently delete. And now like on Gmail.
You archive everything, yeah. But it's at least out of sight, and you can get it if you have to, but it shouldn't be there. The idea is you shouldn't be reminded of it every time you open your email, because that's taxing.
And it is taxing.
And your mind, it occupies mind share.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the key principles for managing your workflow effectively. You need to minimize your cognitive workload.
Yeah.
So if every time you open your email, you're seeing the same emails there, you got to do something about, or you've already done something about, but they're still there, you are adding clutter to your mind and you are distracting yourself. So don't do that. I would argue, I mean, I know most people, they do that because they don't know any better. And I understand that's okay. I don't advocate like being hard on ourselves, but at the end of the day, it's a form of bad stewardship if we don't correct that, because we are adding distraction and clutter and we're weighing ourselves down.
So there are so many helpful tips here and things that we can enact in our daily execution of our tasks and be better stewards of the grace we've received. But there can be a danger. You can become preoccupied with the system, or it can become a new law. That's something you talk about. You actually connect it to our justification by grace alone through faith alone. How do we prevent the system, the productivity system, from becoming, you know, some sort of neo-nomian variety of business self-help productivity?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, the system can become a new law. Normally we think of law in terms of, you know, the Old Testament ceremonial law or tradition that we've added to scripture.
Yeah. But, Phariseeism or something like that. Yeah.
But our own to-do list can become a law as well. The law of, you know, like in Luther's categories, the law is any requirement to do something. That's what law is. And law is not necessarily intrinsically bad,
sure,
but the law cannot save us. And the law cannot be our ultimate source of peace of mind, because we're sinful people. We cannot do the law perfectly. And that applies not just to God's law, but also our own desires and our own lists we create. And I found with GTD, my peace of mind started resting on my ability to get my lists done and capture everything. I said, this isn't good. This can't be helpful. So I started thinking about this in relation to, the categories of law and gospel and justification. And that was also in part a response to my pastor. He kept pressing me, saying, why are you learning all this about productivity? You're a theology guy. And
right.
That was discouraging for a while. But the main lesson I took from that was, hey, think about everything in a theological way. And that's a good lesson. And so I learned that lesson from him. And that's when I realized I need to be very deliberate about connecting this to the great doctrines of the faith. And the connections are there. They're natural. I didn't have to invent them. I just had to find them. And there they are. And the key connection I make is the only way to be productive is to realize you don't have to be productive.
Yeah.
That's simply a restatement of the great Protestant doctrine and biblical doctrine of justification by faith alone. We are accepted by God through faith alone, apart from works, that is, apart from our productivity. And we can rest in that. We stand right with God and with a title to heaven simply on the basis of the work of Jesus. And now we can do good works and create to-do lists to remember the good works that we want to do. But do it from freedom, not constraint. Do it from gratitude and love, because we're so grateful for what Christ has done for us, and we want to reflect him and honor him in the world. And we do these things now freely because we want to, not because we have to. And that also gives us the freedom to stop and say, I can't do anymore today. I am exhausted. And we can stop without guilt and without beating ourselves up because of our limitations.
Yeah. Amen to that. You know, that brings me here just in my last question I'd like to ask is about part 7. Part 7 to your book here titled Living This Out. And you have two sections in here, productivity in organizations and society, as well as the greatest cause in the world. Why did you find it important to include this section of the book? And why is it really an apropos or a fitting conclusion to what you've been building towards with this entire book?
Absolutely. You know, my publisher wanted me to cut that chapter out for space constraints, actually. And I certainly understand the space constraints.
Sure.
I certainly do understand that. But I said to them, I cannot cut that out. I will not cut that out, because the book is not complete without it, because we need to understand our productivity in relation to God's global purposes. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, God has global purposes and calls us to be involved in them. So we are ultimately disobedient if we don't conceive of our productivity in relation to God's global purposes. And second, it gives even greater meaning to what we do, to see how they what we do connects with God's purposes. Now, I'm not saying God's ultimate purpose is on the mission field and for missionaries. I'm not saying missions work is the only work that matters or anything like that. And I talk about that in the chapter. The chapter originally was like three or four times as long as it is in the book now, though. And I spent the first half of that chapter actually talking about what I mean when I say the greatest cause in the world, because I call missions the greatest cause in the world. And earlier in the book, I said, hey, if you're making sandwiches at Chick-fil-A and doing it for the glory of God, that might be just as important as a person preaching the gospel in Africa, if that's what God has called you to do at that time. But now I'm saying missions is the greatest cause in the world. What's going on? So I love the full, real version of that chapter, but I had to cut it down. But what I argue is really the greatest cause in the world is the glorification of God and the advancement of the gospel. And our work is an essential component in how God furthers his purposes. It's not just preaching the gospel, though that's essential, but our work in doing it in a God-centered way for the good of others rather than our own glory or our own interests, it reflects something about Jesus Christ. It reflects on him well. And I argue actually a good, robust understanding of the doctrine of vocation is going to be key to the task of world missions and actually reaching all nations with the gospel. And right now, things are getting better, but the church still hasn't recaptured that fully robust doctrine of vocation and doctrine of work. And the cause of missions is suffering. So I want to show people in that chapter how the things they do every day, even if it feels so mundane and boring, actually relates to God's global purposes. And I want to call missionist agencies and nonprofits that are doing good for the world in Jesus' name to be more effective in what they're doing and encourage them in what they're doing and help everyone understand how no matter where they are, they can be a part of what God is doing to bring the gospel to all nations.
Well, thank you, Matt. I really appreciate part seven especially, but also the entire book. I would encourage people to get a copy because there's so much in here and there are so many recommended resources at the back, and I'm working through them myself, reading a number of the books. I read some Peter Drucker books. I was already reading one on managing the nonprofit organization.
Yep, that's a good one.
So our supporters of Reform Forum could be happy about that. But also Stephen Covey's First Things First, David Allen's Getting Things Done, Scott Belsky's Making Ideas Happen. I did not know about that book. I bought it and read it and loved it.
Good book.
Yeah, and there's so many. I mean, and those are just the ones on the getting things done aspect. He also includes several Christian books on developing a vision for your life. Just for example, John Piper's Don't Waste Your Life. But there's a whole host of resources, and it makes this book a very effective book at that. And I mean that in the sense that the book intends. So pick up a copy of this. What's Best Next? How the Gospel Transforms the Way You Get Things Done by Matt Perman has a wonderful glowing foreword by John Piper. It is published by Zondervan. It's available at Amazon and WTSBooks.com and other places. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. I had a good time.
Well, you can visit Matt online at whatsbestnext.com. There you'll find information about what he's up to, and he has a running blog where you can subscribe and learn more, so the book keeps on going. You can also find us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs as well as how to get in touch with us. We love hearing from you. You can tweet us at Reformed Forum or email us at mail@reformedforum.org. We thank you so much for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.